Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's RealCom Live. Exciting conversation today. If you know how I usually name one word or one phrase, today is show me the money. And what we're going to be talking about is all of the investing that's been going on in the prop tech space, probably starting around 2009. And we've seen an inordinate amount of money pushed into the commercial and corporate real estate sector. As it relates to technology. And we've got one of those folks who was in early, understands it probably better than anybody, and has got a very good handle on the state of prop tech investing today and what we're going to see in the next couple of years. So with that, let's bring on our guest today and get this conversation. Zach, so good to see you. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me, Jim.
Yeah, it's, you know, I'll tell you, this has been a topic that's been near and dear to my heart. Probably since 2009, right? Because after the financial crash, you know, a big hit to the economy, a big hit to, you know, economic cycles. And we saw a lot of capital start to come back into the market in 2009. And so that's what, 15 years now. And, you know, even in those 15 years, we've had some ups and down cycles. So before we get started, why don't you give everybody a little bit of your background so they can get some context as we have this conversation.
No problem. So I have experience both in the early stage venture capital and tech startup community, going back since around that time. I started my career at a very opportune time, a couple years before the global financial crisis. So had some experience with investment banking, then had a tech startup of my own in the travel and tourism sector called Travel Goat. That's how I got into the, at the time, nascent New York City tech community around 2009. But I've always been interested in real estate growing up. My dad remains a real estate developer with Millennium Partners, where I worked for many years. And so I was always around it, always interested in getting into real estate. When it came time to transition out of my startup, I was fortunate enough to work as a project manager doing real estate development work, doing leasing work, property management work, and then on the side was building up a portfolio of what we now would call prop tech startups around that time when we were seeing consumerization of the enterprise. We were seeing a move from on-prem systems starting to cloud in the sector, and it felt like a really exciting time for me to get involved. That's probably around, I probably met you all around 2012, 2013. There seemed to be a new wave of startups, and I was able to invest in a lot of them as an angel investor, and then in my job as a property manager and developer, be an early customer of many of these emerging technologies, as well as a customer and evangelist of a lot of the technology products that had been around the ecosystem for decades. I think a lot of people lose perspective, but prop tech software has been around since 1973.
Well, yeah, it's funny. We actually put together an infogram that shows the what we call the five phases. And you're absolutely right. From 2009 till about 2015, 2016, we call that phase four. And then phase five, which we actually called out in about 2018, had all the AI and the next gen stuff. So you're absolutely right.
No. Yeah. So if you fast forward to 2015, I'd already been involved as a customer evangelist investor in the ecosystem and sort of leveraged that reputation to create my own platform, Metaprop. And I've been doing that since. We're going to celebrate 10 years next
Hard
year.
I believe 10 years.
Yes. You were some of the first people who sort of picked up the phone and understood what we were trying to do. So many thanks to you guys for helping us out and believing in us early on. But, as of today, we've been investing as a firm since then. We now manage a little under 250 million assets under management across many early stage funds and one growth and opportunity vehicle, so we can get involved in these startups really at any stage pre-IPO in their evolution. And our main job is to train them on how to sell into the sector and then open up our Rolodex and tell them what events they should be at and who they should be selling to within organizations who tend to be the more forward-thinking customers who are actually buying their solution and who might be more of a of a tire kicker. Yeah. So, well, it up a portfolio over the years, and you know, as always, thrilled to talk about different trends we're seeing right now as they play out in the in the early stage and the growth stage.
What I think some of the most interesting points you made was the fact that you came from the industry, you had hands-on experience running and operating a building. Right. And a lot of the startups that I've seen, you know, had very little have very little real estate experience. So that the fact that you've literally have rolled up your sleeves and gotten your hands dirty, I think gives you a better perspective to be able to see those legitimate solutions as opposed to the ones that might be playing at the edge, you know?
Yeah, I think at this point, it's important for us to have the sector has matured over the years, and the level of sophistication at the customer level, at the real estate company level, the construction company, the contractor, the architect level is so much higher than 10 years ago, 20 years ago. And so the way we are preparing our companies to sell in is a little different, but the good news, the bad news is that there's more competition and more saturation. But the good news is that the sophistication level is much higher, and all of the partners who come to us, whether it be in real estate or construction, they tell us, here are five or six priorities for the year, and these are what the practice groups can effectively digest in terms of engaging with new technology, and this is what we want to look at, and the rest of it, happy to hear about it once per year, but this is not our programmatic focus. Right. And 10 years ago, that conversation would not have happened. The people would not have been at the organization who could get that information out of the practice groups and then digest it and distill it back to me. We've seen tremendous growth of sophistication adoption in the sector.
It's gone deeper into the organization. Yep. So, I mean, you have been in the catbird seat on this, you know, on prop tech investing, being out of Manhattan, being one of the early firms focused solely on the real estate industry. To me, it kind of feels like things peaked 24 months ago, even though it still might have been going up a little bit, you know, the hype and the momentum, but it felt like it may be a couple years ago peak. Give me your assessment of the last 24 months, where we are today and where we're going to be 24 months from now.
Yeah, there was a sort of run up in 21 of real estate, construction, and technology sort of all at once. And so prop tech and architecture, engineering, construction tech, where we play, enjoyed a double bump of sorts from a market that was already frothy. And so you saw a lot of overfunding in the category in 21. And then when interest rates started getting hiked in 22, you saw the double whammy of a rapid retrenchment, because you saw a retrenchment in the commercial real estate markets, residential real estate markets, lending markets, as well as in the broader venture capital markets, and the IPO market kind of seized up.
Have we figured out, though, why that happened in the middle of a pandemic when we were all locked up? I'm still trying to figure out, why did we see that big bump in 2021 when effectively we're in the middle of a pandemic?
Well, the peak of the market as it relates to the public equity market and the private prop tech market, the public equity market peaked in Q4 of 21. I would say the private early venture market, which always lags, it lags on the downside and lags on the upside by about 6 to 12 months, depending on the cycle. So we didn't really see a peak in the venture market until sort of the end of Q1 22.
That makes sense.
And we were sort of out of the pandemic-ish, I would say, by then. You started seeing things fully opening up, I would say, by the end of 21, early 22. Yep. So keep in mind, financial markets always foreshadow, Wall Street always foreshadows Main Street. It sort of foreshadows it on the way up, foreshadows it on the way down. There's a drawdown before there's a recession, before there's a sort of drop in employment, right? And then on the way up, you see Wall Street, and this is some of what we saw last year, obviously driven by some AI excitement, but we saw a run up in public equity last year, And then we're sort of looking to see if that slowdown on Main Street we were promised is actually going to happen, or if we're really going to have the soft landing. And I think the employment data from today suggests they might actually pull off some sort of Main Street soft landing. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean there's a soft landing in the financial markets. I think for the financial markets, it's bumpy. I think a couple of things that we're seeing opening up are the IPO market seems to be reopening after a pretty long hiatus, and the M&A market seems to be becoming a little bit more active, a little bit more liquid after an absolutely dismal year last year.
Well, and you know, fintech, prop tech, legal tech, education tech, whatever, we're getting hit a little bit harder because, again, during the pandemic, this global work from home experiment really kind of recalibrated people's thinking about going into the office, right? So in addition to these other, you know, general tech sectors, we've got a real estate market that's struggling a little bit. What are you seeing on the streets as far as, you know, office buildings in Manhattan or LA? You know, are we in a paradigm shift or is this a cycle? I mean, what's your sense?
I think we're in a very similar paradigm shift that we experienced in retail, where it was a shift. It is a shift, but the histrionics were overblown, and the idea that e-commerce was going to eat up total retail market share overnight just proved to not be the case. And we saw a mean reversion in terms of e-commerce adoption. And because of the combination of that and just economic growth and business generation, we've seen a return to excitement in retail real estate, not for every asset, but in retail as an asset type. Whereas if you talk to somebody in 2020 about retail in the middle of the pandemic, right, they would not have wanted to have a conversation with you. I think what we're seeing now is we're in the middle of that cycle as it relates to office. I think if the economy can still continue to print job growth and the economy can still print business growth and there's hiring and there's creation of new business and there's hiring, we are going to see a mean reversion as it relates to office. And we're going to see demand catch up with oversupply in the market because there's no new office buildings being underwritten right
now. Would you agree, though, with that a fair amount of the office stock is now quasi-functionally obsolete? Maybe not
everything. I mean, what's interesting is stuff that was Class A in the 1960s, but is not well amenitized, not particularly sustainable, and not well located, is totally functionally obsolete. Right. And it either has to be knocked down or reimagined. So I think what a lot of people fail to understand is that modern office buildings that aren't modern enough to be desirable are worse off than pre-World War II office buildings.
Totally agree.
Because of the means of how they were constructed and therefore the feasibility of potential conversion to other asset types.
When you're talking about square versus rectangle?
when you have these huge floor plates, other than turning them into EV charging centers or vertical farms, they cannot be repurposed into anything other than a different type of office. They cannot be repurposed into a hotel or residential. It just doesn't work based on any city code in the world that I'm familiar with. So I think, yes, there are functionally obsolete office buildings, just as there are functionally obsolete interior C-minus malls that no one wants. That doesn't mean you still read about Simon reinvesting $400 million into a Class A mall because they clearly just believe that if they amenitize it, re-tenant it, and put technology in it, that $400 million is going to be money good.
So that's a good segue. I mean, obviously, I've spent my career trying to convince people that, you know, there is a relationship between a building and technology. 20, 25 years, you know, constant. The pandemic convinced us that there was a threat to some existing work models. In the future, I mean, are we at that point now where building owners and operators have no choice? They can't get to a modern amenitized building without a significant investment in technology. Is that a fair statement?
I think it's a fair statement. Before I got on the online here, I watched a video from HQO, one of our portfolio companies, right? They help people get back in the office, and it's now a need to have. If you want to be offering your tenants a good experience, your customers now, You need technology. You need technology to manage the experience as it relates to the wellness of the building, the air quality, the energy expenditure, the water quality, the tinting, and then also as it relates to them being able to get their car, get a latte, book conference space. Well,
so I'm going to shift gears a little bit. We'll move away from office for 30 seconds. I mean, I agree with you 1,000%, by the way, but practically speaking, I mean, our event last year in Las Vegas, I was charged $5,000 or $4,000 for 5 megabits of broadband. Okay. I mean, think about that. Your phone in a new 5G, you know, implemented marketplace can do, you know, 200-300 megabits on your phone. And yet these buildings, in that case, a convention center, wanted to charge me $4,000 for 5 megabits. I mean, how do we get the business processes associated with bringing technology into these buildings? How do we update that process, get those folks on board?
That's a great question. I mean, you have to figure out how to incentivize them better. And I think we need a better exchange of data and incentives. And we need everybody to know each other's incentives. There's still a lot of middle people involved in real estate. There's a lot of distribution networks, right, that people have to deal with, procurement.
With their own agendas
and their own P&Ls. So I don't have one solution for that, but I think.
And this is where innovation comes in. Next week's episode is a company we've been using for a few years. When we go into these big facilities that can't give us competitive broadband at a reasonable price. And basically what they did was they bond 3 different cell signals to create our own Wi-Fi network. Right. I mean, that's how innovation starts to creep in against these practices that have been around for 20, 30 years. I don't think it's the technology anymore. I think it's the organizational infrastructure of a lot of these existing companies that for some reason or another don't want to change. And that's, I think, what we're all fighting.
Yeah, I think everybody in our industry fights organizational culture change resistance. And, you know, historically, real estate has made money hiding and obfuscating data. So it's definitely a new way of thinking.
I've never been a call out guy, you know, like call people out, but I'm wondering if maybe every one RealCom Live once a month, we should like have a shaming episode where, I mean, I told you I'm in a hotel today, fairly new hotel, pretty edgy hotel, and I needed to find a place to do a podcast and it was a disaster. I mean, what does that mean? A quiet space with a little bit of light and maybe someplace to, you know, plug in my laptop and a microphone. I mean, give me 60 square feet in the lobby of a hotel to do a podcast, and that feels modern.
I think the office sector has learned over the past, probably starting in 18 and through the pandemic, that they need to become more like a hotel. The hotel sector has yet to learn they need to be more like an office. They are going to survive long term.
Yeah. Well, we're going a little bit over. I got one more question before we take a break. Prop tech investing next 24 to 36 months, stay the same, neutral? Do we start seeing an increase, a little more correction? What do you see?
I think we're going to see, I think 24 is definitely going to be higher levels than 23. 23, we had a relative trough, but was still, just for context, higher than 18. So it's just, we had that crazy sugar high of 21 and 20 that kind of skewed the market. But I do see growth, especially if we can print some more general tech IPOs and then some more real estate and construction related M&As. I think the Home Depot coming out and doing that $18 billion roofing distribution deal, which is PE backed, is great for the sector. I want to see more M&A coming in the back half of the year. And I want to see IPOs. And I also want to see more clarity, you know, on the residential side, as it relates to the new rules vis-a-vis the litigation. I think that will also, and then God willing, a rate cut or two could serve as a real nice.
We're going to have to get you back on because I want to spend a half hour with you just talking about debt, right? And what are we going to do with this debt that it's out there, it's hanging out there. We've got some valuation issues, but a different conversation for a different time. Let's take a quick break. We're going to come back and talk about our favorite 2024 topic, artificial intelligence. All right. Well, that was a perfect commercial for a segue into this topic. So real quick, our journey AI started 2018 when we introduced on our general session stage, you know, because we had heard some of the things with Google DeepMind and the Go Championship. We, like most, fell asleep until ChatGPT end of 2022. At that point, we jumped in quick. It was a part of our conference last year. And then in the fall, we did Buildings AI in Silicon Valley to kind of get the momentum started. We've now created an advisory group. And in the AI at our conference in two plus months is going to be incredible. It's going to be in every session, the general session. We created a new event called Buildings AI Symposium, 2.5-hour event that's focusing just on AI. No hype, no generalities, legitimate case studies. We're partnering with Microsoft. They're bringing their senior level execs, AI execs in, so it's going to be exciting. So that's our perspective. You're in the midst of, you know, one of the most intense investment, prop tech investment communities in the world. High level, what are you seeing with AI?
We're seeing a lot of hype around it, obviously, and you have to be careful when you're in venture. And there's all the folks who are starting sort of whatever the fad is, there's always going to be entrepreneurs starting businesses within that fad. However, we're seeing tremendously interesting things happening that are investable opportunities for our funds, and then our existing portfolio leveraging AI tools, pretty much each and every one of them, to enhance their own operations internally. And so a couple of themes we're looking at specifically with respect to generative AI and training large language models, permitting data, one of the things we're diving deep into. 80% of permits are kicked back to the developer, architect, expediter because of a basic clerical error, not some technical disagreement in the code, but a very simple to correct error, like the wrong seal on a document. We think opportunities like that are just tremendous for artificial intelligence, specifically this new wave of generative AI. We were discussing earlier image generation. The entire architecture and design world is just exploding as a result of AI. Also, we're seeing huge efficiency in the mortgage business. We have a company in the portfolio that where it can automatically chat with a borrower and update the loans available, connects to a suite of APIs on the back end, but effectively ChatGPT for getting a mortgage. We have a company called Palazzo, effectively ChatGPT for interior design, designing your room.
I saw a demo, as I shared with you in the green room, I saw a demo of Zaha Hadid, you know, one of the largest, most innovative architectural firms in the world. And we sat there for 20 minutes, just stunned what they were showing us. I mean, instantaneous changes in architectural renderings. I mean, things that used to take months now take minutes or seconds, right? And it's like, how do you take a process that used to be, you know, 30 days and reduce it to a minute? What are the implications of that? They're huge.
It's extraordinary. And the implications also, one of the, on the legal front, in terms of how to deal with the data when an architect like Zaha Hadid Architects is generating their own designs, but it's based on their own previous designs, and it's also based on Brunelleschi's designs, but no one knows exactly what it's based on because it's going through one of these bots. It's an interesting issue.
Well, the demo, I don't want to steal any thunder because they're going to be at the conference showing this, but imagine you don't have a building, but you have a digital district. So you got, you know, 30 buildings, you know, 9 city blocks, and you just prompt in, change the exterior design from brick to concrete or stucco. And I'm talking instantaneously. Increase the glass windows by 30%. And the whole city just changes right in front of your eyes.
And if you can feed in the code properly as well, you can build to whatever the code of a particular
city. And then you tie it with your financial data and you can cost it out in another 90 seconds, right?
Absolutely.
What would this cost me to build in Detroit? You know,
we visited in the outskirts of Tokyo. We visited the Mita Corp headquarters. They're one of the largest general contractors in the Japanese market. They had a whole room where they would render a cityscape then 3D print it, and then run it through a wind tunnel to determine, and seismic. We just had an earthquake here in
I heard, yeah.
We felt here in New York, but they are able to run tests. For example, if you match up the image generation that AI can do with the 3D printing capabilities available now, imagine the real life testing they can do for things like seismic, things like wind impact. It's just unprecedented. And so there's a lot of really exciting things for us. We're sort of picking our spots with where we're investing. We've certainly adopted AI internally tremendously. We don't do a lot of super creative things as a venture capital firm, but as it relates to internal communications, as it relates to taking and cleaning data from different meetings and getting insights from it, or even communicating our insights to our investor base. It's just been a tremendous uplift of productivity.
Well, and you said a word earlier, you know, the hype phase. We as an organization made a promise to ourselves and the community that this event was going to get beyond the hype. And that's actually our theme this year, beyond the hype, using real technology to solve real business problems in a challenging market, right? Kind of three different thoughts jammed into one. But we've been killing ourselves just, you know, going through hundreds of conversations to find legitimate case studies in AI impacting our industry. Now, are they fully baked? Maybe not. But some of the stuff I've seen even in the last 90 days is legit.
Yeah.
And we're going to have a showcase where all these are going to be on display and you're going to be able to go talk to people. It's not like a booth. It's more like a meeting where you just get to go chat with people, see what they're doing, and then have a conversation.
Yeah, and I've seen this renewed interest in AI has buttressed interest in other technologies that we've been investing in for a while, whether it's machine learning or computer vision or complex rote automation technologies, right? These are not exactly the same as this wave, but I'm seeing a really renewed excitement for something like automation, partially because
of AI.
These executives are trying out these AI tools and realizing how much you know they can benefit.
Yeah, I mean, when an executive applies AI to a 100 million square foot portfolio of leases, you know, that range in 5, 10, 15 years, and can get guidance on that lease portfolio in a split second, it gets their attention. It gets their attention. All right. So I got one more, we're out of time, but I got one more question for you. A new startup, you know, a company that you may talk to, as it relates to AI, what advice do you give anybody who comes knocking on your door, about, you know, what their position should be on AI as far as prop tech is concerned?
Yeah. I think if you're a prop tech company, if you are not, creating your own angle on generative AI, whether that's like your own LLM or your own platform, don't call yourself an AI company. You can call yourself something else that is very AI focused and leverages AI tools. I think if you talk to some of our automation companies, firms like Mayburn, they do fund automation, firms like Advocate, they do insurance compliance automation. They'll be the first to tell you they're not building in generative AI, but their employees use a lot of it and they know about it and they're sort of hip to it. So I think being true to what your product actually does and the problem it is solving, I think if your product has any opportunity to leverage these tools, embrace it.
Well, yeah.
Because that's what the generalist venture capital community is capitalizing right now. Right.
Well, what we, you know, in our journey, we've come up with maybe three dozen legitimate case studies, even more, kind of categorized into about 12 different groups. But what we found kind of at the high level is that AI applied against our industry, four categories, like you said, personal productivity, organizational productivity, are we using it ourselves? Two, enterprise automation, the property management, lease admin, that stuff, you know, going to be tightened up, made more efficient. Then there's the smart building side, the building itself, right? You know, the lights, the locks, the windows, everything there. And then the fourth, and this was added about 3 weeks ago, is communications between the entire ecosystem. So tenant to landlord, landlord to supplier, AI is going to impact the whole communication. So far we got four major categories that AI in our industry is seemingly getting shoved in.
And design, I mean, we talked about it a lot. Design is for sure. Yeah, no, I think that's right on.
Design is. I mean, and we don't usually handle the architectural design conversation at RealCom and IBCom, but we are this year because the advancements are so crazy. So, well, unfortunately, we're out of time. I mean, we're gonna have to get you back on because I got a whole, you know, another dozen questions to ask, and I know you're in the middle of all the craziness as it relates to, you know, prop tech investing, and are always willing to share good, honest insight, and we appreciate that.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on, and I'm looking forward to Tampa later this year.
Yeah, it's going to be wild. I guarantee you that. Have a great day.
Thank you. You too.
All right. So now let's bring on Mr. Berger so he can give us this news. And Howard, I don't know if every story is about AI. Hopefully not. But why don't you give us a little rundown of the news?
Actually, Jim, this week, we're not heavy on AI this week.
Good. Let me get out of here.
All right. Well, thanks, Jim. Hey, and Zach, thank you. That was really great conversation. I really enjoyed having you with us today. So moving on to the news, here's a couple of stories from our weekly news briefing. It goes out every Thursday morning. So as Jim mentioned, we're going to be light on AI today. So our first story, Amazon's announced the discontinuation of its Just Walked Out technology in favor of the DashCart system in its U.S. Amazon Fresh stores. So Just Walk Out, it's the Amazon retail tech that uses sophisticated network of cameras to automatically charge customers for their items. So it's going to be replaced by the Dash Cart, which uses scanners actually attached to the shopping carts. So Just Walk Out, it worked really well in smaller stores, and it's going to stay in the Amazon Go stores in the UK. Customers in larger US stores have opted for a more traditional shopping experience, and they'll get the Dash Cart system. Broad adoption may be challenging as grocery stores, they have pretty slim profit margins. They may balk at the investment. Plus, you've got some regulatory hurdles for restricted items like tobacco and alcohol, which really complicate integration. But despite these challenges, retail automation technology continues to gain traction, and Amazon and Walmart and Target are driving a lot of this innovation. Next, so Department of Energy released its first ever federal blueprint to decarbonize America's building sector. The Biden-Harris administration unveiled Decarbonizing the U.S. Economy by 2050, a national blueprint for building sector. And this aims to reduce GHG from buildings from 65% by 2035 and by 90% by 2050. It's a major collaborative effort between the U.S. Department of Energy along with other federal agencies. And this blueprint delineates four strategic goals. Number one, energy efficiency. Two, on-site emissions reductions. Three, grid interactions. And four, minimizing emissions from building materials. To reach these targets, DOE is promoting building upgrades, electrification, smart controls. They also aim to have less than half the cost of home energy upgrades within a decade in order to hit the net zero emissions 2050 target date. Next, I want to shout out to this week's technology partner, especially Mark Pitok, Vice President, Chief Marketing Communications Officer at Linkspring, for his article on OT data. So operational technology or OT data automation is going to be critical in optimizing building operations, managing rising energy costs, promoting sustainability in today's smart buildings. So we generate truckloads of data from numerous systems and devices, and which, if it's approached properly, can yield a goldmine of insights to enhance operations and business results. But the focus is no longer on collecting as much data as you can muster, but on acquiring the right data, properly, you know, and properly connected, normalized, and tagged for actionable use. It involves standardizing the data, ensuring its accessibility to the right people at the right time in a secure manner. You cover all of those bases, and that data can do its job in elevating sustainable, healthy, optimized building operations. A great article. Thanks, Mark. Finally, more on the retail tech front. So to combat theft and accidental losses, Walmart installed artificial intelligence technology across more than 1,000 of its stores. This is called their missed scan detection program. And it uses camera-based computer vision. It alerts staff whenever an item bypassed the checkout scanner without first being scanned, which will then prompt employees to intervene as necessary. So while Walmart acknowledges most incidents are accidental, the technology also serves as a deterrent to would-be thieves. So since the introduction of this technology 2 years ago, Walmart's seen a remarkable decline in shrinkage rates. And of course, there are questions regarding customer privacy. While security cameras are pretty common in retail, the use of AI to scrutinize shopper activity is relatively new. No details yet on how Walmart is handling the data collected, including its retention period and whether it contains any identifying information. Although the company has yet to respond, it's clear that customers may be unaware of AI's role in their shopping experience. So I'm sure there's going to be more debate on this in the weeks and months to come, and we'll keep an eye on that. So Jim, those were just a few of this week's highlighted stories, and I wish everyone a great weekend, and back to you.
Yeah. So just a quick note on the one Walmart story. I know, Walmart has multiple divisions, the retail stores and then the campus group, but I am just so pleased to have, someone from Walmart as one of our co-chairs on the IBCon side, and the insight that he's bringing to us. And you know, it's one thing to innovate, but it's another thing to innovate at scale. And Neil has been, sharing some of the strategy that Walmart's going through and is bringing that to the conference and sessions, and he's going to bring that insight into the general session. We had Cindy Margolis on from Walmart last year at a high level, and now we're going to start really digging into what is Walmart doing at their incredibly innovative new campus. Really, I'd say setting global standards as far as what corporate real estate campuses need to look like going forward. So,
and that's on the headquarters front, but also on the retail storefront, we have another advisor, Zorba, who was on the SWAT teams that were actually developing some of these very, very interesting IoT technologies that they are implementing in their retail stores.
Yeah. The people that make up the RealCom community just are so deep. Yeah, incredibly devoted, smart, highly technical people. So great job on the news, and thank you much. You have a great weekend.
You all too. Thank you.
Well, thanks. All right, before we wrap, let's hear from our final sponsor, and I'll be back with what we're going to be going over next week. All right. Next week's topic is one that is incredibly near and dear to my heart. I've been what you would call a mobile warrior for longer than many of our new RealCom community members have been alive. Okay. I was that guy in a hotel room in Manhattan with my 2400 baud modem and alligator clips and screwdriver, taking off the cover to the phone on the wall and clipping in my alligator clip so I could send email from the hotel room. And over the years, we've all become fairly used to and dependent on the concept of ubiquitous wireless, whether it's our cell phone or Wi-Fi. And I got to tell you, for being 2024, we have not achieved where we need to be, in my opinion. Our 5G networks are good, but when you compare them to other 5G networks around the world, the speed, the robust, the latency, we're not necessarily leading the way. You go into top tier hotels and you expect to get good Wi-Fi. And sometimes, you go to the lobby and you struggle. Personally, as a conference company, we've been into so many facilities where we're, asked to pay $4,000 or $5,000 for a 5 megabit internet connection. And if you think about that, in some areas on your phone, you can get 200, 300. So next week, we are going to be talking to a company we've actually been using for a number of years that has come up with a technology strategy where they bond various cellular signals together to create Wi-Fi connectivity. Incredible technology. It's got so many applications in the built environment. And we're going to hear from two great guys from that company, Ian and Michael, to share with us the technology, what their plans are, and how getting broadband into every square inch of every building is not impossible. So with that, I want to say thank you to our guests today, to our sponsors and the team that puts this together. And I look forward to seeing you all next week on RealCom Live.